Hey everybody, I think we're are we live now?
Is you
this
are?
Thing working? Absolutely fantastic. Red, thanks very much for doing this again. It's always, you know, it's you that makes this thing work. You are the queen of internet radio, and I think someday there's going to be a statue to you somewhere, and it'll be well deserved.
Okay, oh, so thank you, Vlad.
It looks like we have, I think, if things go according to plan, I think we're going to have a fantastic show. I've got somebody very special lined up, a couple of people who are really special guests lined up who are extremely interesting, very informative. You're going to be getting CIA-level briefing on the situation in terms of infiltration and subversion in Canada. And that's coming up in just a very few minutes. I'm really excited about that. One of my favorite, I'm not going to say he's a blogger because he doesn't run a blog. I run a blog. This guy runs a website which is solid, unimpeachable, legally actionable information about certain organizations in Canada and where how those organizations are connected and what they do and the consequences. And there are things that will horrify most people to know. And basically, you know, you got to wonder, did the RCMP, does CSIS, do does the CSE, do these organizations even know this stuff that this fellow has accumulated all on his own, at his own expense, on his own time, with his own expertise, has accumulated for us, and he's going to be here in a few minutes, and that's going to be both highly, highly depressing and very exciting for us all. Just before we do, though, before we bring him on, I just want to say a couple of things that I plan to say every week, because, you know, the more I think about it, the more I realize that there's a couple of sort of memes, if you like, a couple of little things that go through my head all the time, and I think it's good for me to crystallize them, and I also think it's good to get them out there. I think people need to start repeating this stuff to each other. And one of them is, you know, there's a lot of talk, not as much as there used to be, but a lot of talk about the importance of freedom of speech. And I think it's important that we sit down and think about what that means to ourselves, to each other. But there's one thing I'm pretty sure of. It only really counts. Like, freedom of speech, there's only one thing about it that matters. So you can, and people who listen regularly, they know I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again. Freedom of speech doesn't just mean saying I like red over blue, or I like blue over red, my favorite color is blue, or I like buying red clothes and wearing red clothes. That's fairly trivial. I think most people would agree that that kind of freedom of speech, although maybe it isn't, right? But really, what freedom of speech is about, it's about criticism of religious and political authority. That's really all there is. That's the most important thing. If you don't have the freedom to criticize religious and political authority, then you don't have anything. Just ask Henry VIII, right? You have nothing. And believe me, if you give up the right to criticize, and that includes mock, ridicule, and humiliate, or whatever, religious authority and political authority, if you give those rights up, the right to say you like red over blue or blue over green or green over red, that right will be gone very, very shortly after. Because if you look at the Islamic world, most of the women, they tend to all wear one color. So they clearly, the idea of I would like to wear a red burqa today, it's just not going to happen. Because once you give up the right to criticize religious authority, it's funny, but suddenly you also give up the right to say what color slave rag that you're going to get to wear, because that if you're choosing your color, you're not truly a slave, right? So how are you doing, Red?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. Not
it's
too
been a
bad.
Good week.
Busy.
Yeah. Have you lots of radio?
Yeah, lots of radio, as usual, again this week. But I had a banner show tonight. I interviewed a counter-jihadist out of the United States, so it was interesting. But I interview people from all spectrums when it comes to religion. So tonight was counter. Tonight was, it goes across the gamut with me. I am all embracing. What can I say, Vlad?
Well, you have to be. I'm glad that you are. Have we got our guest on the line? Are we ready to bring him on?
We most certainly do. Mr. Mark Leboux is joining us right now. Let me know when you want me to bring the gentleman on the air with you.
Go ahead. Hit the button. Let's bring him on. Mark Leboux, are you there?
All right. Good evening.
Mark, great to hear your voice. I'm so glad you were able to find time in your unbelievably busy schedule, especially considering that, you know, you're a volunteer at all levels. So I'm really glad you could take some time out and join us. So first of all, before, let me say, the website is pointdebascule.ca, right?
Now
this show,
Point Bascule Canada, yeah.
Now tonight's show is going to be really focusing on Canada, right? Really focusing on Canada. But those of you that might be listening from Europe or from the States should realize that anything that Mark may say that's taking place here is likely taking place wherever it is that you are. It's just that there aren't that many people focusing on this kind of work because it's not as easily, it doesn't sell as many newspapers as, you know, a public beheading. It's just, it's a lot less sort of sexy on the surface of it. This takes effort and it takes thought, but in fact it's considerably more important and has greater effect than a lot of the stuff that we are aware of. So perhaps I can ask you to talk about the most recent article that you just published. I think that was the culmination of a great deal of research, was it not?
Yes, it is. I mean, we've been, well, first of all, point bascule in English means tipping point. And just to make sure that maybe the audience understand where it comes from, it's not that it was not intended at the beginning to be a tipping point towards doom and gloom, but rather a hopeful tipping point where if we brought up proper type of information, maybe at one point or another, journalists and the media would actually do their job and inform the population or their readers or their audience of what is currently occurring. And of course, after all those years, we can see that the tipping point hasn't happened, and so the name stayed on. What we do, usually what we do is we focus on organization and the leadership, specifically of Islamist organization and militancy. And we describe their means and methods to be able to advance their agenda in either the judicial, either just normal society in general, but mainly the judicial and very, very sensitive areas of society. And there's also how they're able to use the current infrastructure to be able to get legitimacy and fund their activities. And just so the audience really understand how the situation is and how free and how at ease the Islamist infrastructure is in Canada compared maybe to even other countries, we have the only organization in the world, according to the Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Watch, apart from the Hamas, to have the only organization in the world who identifies and promote the Muslim Brotherhood agenda, and also naming Hassan al-Banna as a model to follow on their own website without any shyness, and clearly defined that way.
Wow.
So sorry, English is not exactly my first language, so once in a while I may look for my words. So this said, we have a core Muslim Brotherhood root with a leadership that is 100% linked with the International Muslim Brotherhood Organization. The leadership of this core Muslim Brotherhood organization are dominant in the integrated North American infrastructure of the Muslim Brotherhood. For example, in the 60s and 70s, there was a man by the name of Ismail Farouki. He took charge of one of the first Islamic studies department in North America. It was at the McGill University. From there, he might have been at the inception of the Muslim Students Association from its very beginning. We have documented information to show that he was very active in 1965, and if we do recall, the Muslim Students Association, which is the first Muslim Brotherhood institution in North America that was founded in 1963. Now, this man later on moved to Temple University, and later on, with the international leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Youssef Qaradawi, founded the IIIT, the International Islamic Institute of Thought, which is the main driving force of scholars driving the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood across North America and now the world. So this man invented a term that was called Islamizing thought. That means that their goal was to be able to come in, their declared goal, not what we interpret, but their declared goal was basically to go in universities, colleges, education institution, and other institution, and to be able to Islamize anything that will counter or any ideology in science, in marketing, and in any form and shape that would go against the Islamic principle. They would try to Islamize that thought and turn it either to counter it or to transform it in such a way that would fit with the precepts of Sharia law. Now, this institution is extremely powerful. Another Canadian, so this is the first Canadian contribution to not only the North American Muslim Brotherhood, but this is the Canadian contribution to the World Wide Web of the Muslim Brotherhood. The second one is Jamal Badawi, and he's going to be important in the report that we're going to talk about. Jamal Badawi is known most likely for the others who've been following the Muslim Brotherhood. He was one of the individuals that was named by name during the Holy Land Foundation trial as a co-conspirator non-accused. And he's extremely influential. He's basically at the helm of several of the core Muslim Brotherhood institution in North America, so either side of the border. And he's extremely influential. The director of CARE Canada, or if you want, the chapter of CARE National, at the time of 2006, declared in a Canadian Senate committee that Jamal Badawi might be one of the most important, the most reliable, the most influential Islamic preacher and leader in North America. So those are their own words. And Jamal Badawi basically explained in not more than once, but and this is where we're going to go with this article, is because we've been very much focused on the violent aspect of Islamism, but we forgot to talk about what leads to violence and how to comply without the use of violence, comply laws or regulation within Sharia. For example, in 2000, Jamal Badawi was interviewed in an article, and he explained to the Muslim that they should accept to become judges, civil servant, and in non-Muslim society, and take advantage of their influential position in order to stop applying current legal provisions that are incompatible with Sharia. These are his own words. And this man is one of the most influential Sunni scholar in North America and specifically in Canada.
Are you aware of any instances where that's actually happened yet?
In terms of, well, in this article that we just published, this report, what we're seeing is there's a set of individuals who are linked with now what we know to be terror link organization, and one of them, Irfan Canada, is literally now listed as a terrorist organization. And while they were on board of this organization, they were invited at a government round table to give advice to ministers of security and also CSIS, if you want, the Canadian CIA or the intelligence services, and the RCMP. And they are so successful that since this year now, the new director of CSIS has basically adopted the pressure that were made by these board members to be able to omit any terms that would describe the Islamic terminology to describe the threat.
So
they replace all those terms by Al-Qaeda-like for the first time in almost 10 years in every CSIS report that have been presented to the Canadian Senate Committee.
Can you explain that a little bit more? In other words, it sounds suspiciously like what the Obama administration forced the FBI to do a few years ago.
And that's exactly what Hussein Hamdani was saying to these people who are in charge of our security, that they should follow the Obama model. And then rather focus on describing it as an Al-Qaeda-like ideology, which now, since we are dealing with the problem of Islamic State and Iraq and Syria, it's pretty odd now to talk about an Al-Qaeda-like ideology when we're having when even the violence of the ideology has increased by many folds. And these people that have joined or that have been invited by these roundtables as advisors to very sensitive agencies within the government of Canada, they presented themselves as the moderating voice to be able to counter radicalization of Muslims. And now, since the Islamic State, obviously any counter radicalization programs that have been established in England, in Canada, and maybe in Australia have been a total failure. Canada might be right now by far and wide exceeding the number of volunteers joining jihadist fronts abroad, far exceeding in a very disproportionate manner more than any countries in the world. That means Canada is now an incubator radicalizing Muslims who are going into what is considered to be mainstream Islamic centers.
You know,
and they are now scratching their head because they've been using terms like Al-Qaeda-like rather than terms that they use themselves, rather than to use the term like caliphate and rather to use the term like jihad. And they are scratching their heads and trying to explain that they don't understand why so many youth and Muslims are joining the forces of Islamic State.
Extraordinary. I'd like to just rewind a bit. Could you talk a tiny bit more about the Muslim Students Association? First of all, I didn't realize it went back as far as 1962, but I think, as I understand it, the MSAs are incredibly influential, well-funded, and directly plugged in as sort of a core of a lot of the other Islamic agencies responsible for civilizational jihad and conscientious subversion and infiltration of Western civilization.
Absolutely. Well, these are basically university students. Again, they are not deprived. They're a very educated bunch. We're talking university-level militants. Well, they were started in 1963 in North America. I don't exactly remember. I think it was around Chicago. And right after, when these students, after they came out of their university education, later on, about a decade later, they decided to start other institutions to be able to penetrate other areas of society. So they created the Islamic Society of North America that was established around, I think, not Minneapolis, but anyway, they established the Islamic Society of North America, the American branch, and after that, the IIIT was also established. And then there's another organization, institution, that plays an incredible role in the United States, and the equivalent of that institution is the Muslim Association of Canada. But in the United States, they call it the MAS, the Muslim American Society. Both of these branches, Jamal Badawi was behind these, almost every one of these institutions, these in the more recent time. So yes, in the core Muslim Brotherhood, the way they're operating in North America, they usually, we can use the Canadian model, the core Muslim Brotherhood, because we can go on, they are so powerful, they're so well organized, that very often we're mixing up what I would call the fringes organization. These are the people who are not part of the core, or the Shura Councils. But the Muslim Brotherhood are so influential, their driving force is so powerful that what they do is they just become technically affiliates. So there's three main driving forces in Canada.
Could you explain that term Shura Councils, please?
The Shura Council is like, it's the model when they want to establish a caliphate-like dynamics. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, even before the acknowledgement of the government, the way they operate is they have a Shura Council, which is a bunch of people that gather together, and then they're going to have a supreme guide inside that Shura Council. This is where you can say that there are real, genuine members, because a lot of people say the Muslim Brotherhood don't carry cards. So the Shura Council is a bunch of people that gather together and that decide how to interpret, let's say, certain Islamic rules within the conditions that they're living in. This is why the Muslim Brotherhood don't necessarily operate in the same manner from one country to the other. They're going to adapt to the situation, and their goal is simply to further their agenda. So they might actually join in a political party that we may favor and that may look on the surface to be dealing with the situation, but they could infiltrate that party. And in the long run, they have enough influence that in so many words, they're able to wedge in a couple of well-placed people that will be able to neutralize, and maybe not set into law, but neutralize certain policies that may be a nuisance to the establishment of Sharia rulings in some communities. So the Shura Council is a group of people that will basically either edict fatwas or take decision on how they're gonna steer the agenda in a certain context or in a certain country or a certain jurisdiction.
I see. So, okay, so now earlier you mentioned about trying to establish judges and other authority figures that would try to lean decision-making and processes in a Sharia-compliant way. I'm aware of instances where this has happened in the United States, although I'm not even sure if the judge was Muslim, but he was extremely Islamic sympathetic and had served with U.S. forces, I think, in Iraq. I'm, of course, referring to the case of the fellow who was wearing a costume and was attacked on the street on Halloween by a Muslim, and then
yes.
The fellow who was attacked was actually charged, even though he was the victim, and it was he wasn't even the person up on charges, and the judge somehow turned it around and ended up penalizing the victim. I think that alone may be unprecedented. But
that's a perfect example of what Badawi basically said to do when you're in this form of authority. That's exactly what you could be doing.
Yes. Are you aware of any instances where that's happened in Canada? I know that it's at the level of the Human Rights Commissions and other sort of annoying, rather committee level, but still very powerful organizations that don't seem to have to use due process. That sort of thing is bread and butter. It's day-to-day.
Well, it does. It did happen. I don't know if you recall, but one of the first test cases that we've done is we tested the Human Rights Commission during the McLean's Ezra Levant, Mark Stein battle.
I'd like you to talk about that in detail. Before you do, I just want to warm up people to know exactly what we're talking about here, because I actually bring this up a lot, and I write about it a lot, and I link to it a lot, because you did this, I think, and this was an unbelievably important thing to have done, and I am shocked that it is not common knowledge or wasn't widely reported. Now, as I understand it, actually, I'm going to let you explain it, but somebody, meaning you, actually had the intelligence and the courage to test whether or not the Human Rights Commissions were acting in a level and even-handed fashion when it came to, hate speech and hate thought crimes. And so what exactly was it that you took an imam, you tried to bring an imam?
Well, we had a gem that was exposed, and it was a convert in the province of Quebec who basically learned his Islam in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And he was preaching in a mosque some of the most virulent type of Islam that we can imagine, which is pretty close to what we're seeing in the Islamic State.
Right.
Just to add to the confusion, basically he's anti-Muslim Brotherhood, but all in all, when you really listen to everything that they're saying, it leads to the same area.
Yeah, it's just the Saudis don't like the Brotherhood because the Brotherhood wants to depose the Saudi royals. But other than that,
it leads to the same area. So basically, this man wrote a book. It was his own book, and of course, he was inspired by preachers like Ibn Baz, who recently died, and basically is an extremely radical Saudi mufti or preacher in Saudi Arabia, and he would basically teach us things that are as silly as if you don't believe that the earth is flat, then there could be a fatwa against you. But anyway, this kind of person was extremely influential in Saudi Arabia, and he was preaching basically that he was targeting what we have in Canada, the Human Rights Commissions, have authority. They have the law behind them in a certain way, and one of them is to be able to define what hate speech is. And there's no clear definition of what hate speech could be, so basically they focus on those who are offended rather than define hate speech. And in a liberal democracy, usually we don't care if there's hate speech or not. What we do care if is if there is incitement.
Correct.
The physical integrity. This is when the government has to intervene, basically, is when somebody will basically call on something that will harm somebody else.
In the United States, you're absolutely right. In Canada, where we tip the balance from freedom of speech into a crime is when there is, exactly as you say, incitement, which is still a little bit vague. In the States,
No. When there is an offense.
Right.
We define it around we don't have a clear definition of what hate speech is, but we define it around how people are feeling offended or not.
Right, that's the problem, yes.
So the groups that are what they call there's a legal term that they call identifiable groups. So women are part of that group, the Jewish community is part of that group. Black people, certain minorities are part of that group. And in his book, he basically targets everything that could be called an identifiable group. And for less than that, Human Rights Commission elsewhere in Canada have been able to stifle speech in a very, very serious manner. There was a preacher who said very maybe distasteful things about gay marriage, but nothing in the likes of killing homosexuals or even close to that. And this man was basically condemned to not write anymore and not preach anymore anything. Basically,
and I think he had
that was related to that topic.
He had to apologize, right?
And he had to apologize on top of it.
Which, most likely, if
he would have had the means, he could have gone to the Supreme Court and the Human Rights Commission would have lost. But most people do not have the funds to be able to escalate to a real, real serious court. So anyway, what we did is we had this imam called Al-Haiti, and he basically wrote a book, and he would say things in his book that the Jews are the scumbags of the world, women provoke, and there was even more forceful terms that don't come to mind, but, you know, the classic of how incredibly, let's say, excuse me, I only have French terms, but degrading terms.
Right.
So, for example, if you send your children to a school where there are no Muslims, you will corrupt their hearts with three little dots. So when I was speaking with the Human Rights Commission, because I sent out a test case and I gave them all the chapters to show and use exactly the laws that they were referring to, so I focus on the identifiable groups, and homosexuals were part of that. Basically, at the beginning, I had two-hour conversation with the representative, and the first time I gave him every chance in the book to be able to make sure that didn't miss anything. And in the first time, and I said, listen, let me read this out loud. He gave me an example of what, let's say, a Ku Klux Klan advocate would have written. And then I wrote, and then I read him out loud. I said, this sounds exactly like this chapter. And I read exactly, almost word for word, an equivalent chapter. And instead of being blacks, they were non-Muslims or Jews.
Right,
he was dead silent at the other end, and then he says, "What we're going to do is we're going to look over this again." I said, "Are you telling me that Jews, homosexuals, and women are not identifiable groups?" The second time we spoke together again, I gave them all the chances in the world, and they decided that he was allowed to incite, in so many words, or do his hate speech. And because it was done under the guise of religion. And I said, well, this is not a religious book. This is not the Quran. This is a book he wrote. And I said, I'm not alluding to what inspired this book. I'm only talking about what he writes and what he says he believes in and what he's teaching. And they decided to give him a free pass and not accuse him. So in so many words, it made the headlines. It was a big deal. It just proved that the Human Rights Commission were basically biased, and they were favoring certain groups. In this case, they were favoring Muslims by not putting them on the same level of how do you say that in English? The same level of judgment as the other people.
Right. As I recall, this particular imam, the one that you brought to their attention, one of the things he said, and this is years ago that I read this, but I read it with great fascination. He said that the most virtuous of infidels is worse than the most sinful and awfully behaved of Muslims. That non-Muslim women are all, I think they're all whores, and that non-Muslim women should be treated in any manner because they're, you know, they're guilty.
Yeah, absolutely.
Muslims.
Yeah, and segregating.
The stuff he said was, it was a violation of the spirit and the letter of the Hate Literature Law Act. I mean, you could bring this guy up on criminal charges, even let alone.
Well, it was borderline. I mean, if you know, we believe in free speech.
Yes.
So if we didn't have the Human Rights Commission and if we didn't have this hate speech law, we would have just challenged this book on the premise of ideas. But this is not what these laws are allowing us to do. They're telling us who can say what and what will define what we can say.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that the first sign of a totalitarian state is selective enforcement. It also means
exactly.
We have way too many laws. You know, Don Laird, who was with us on last week's show, and actually has a great deal of practical knowledge about certain things that are taking place, changes that are taking place in Alberta, and absurd examples of infiltration and subversion and development by certain agencies. I wonder if we could. I'd love to have the two of you speak, because, like I said earlier, this is really going to be the Canadian edition of this show, and I think Canada sort of is off the radar of the counter jihad because we've managed to thwart a lot of kinetic acts of jihad in this country, and as a consequence of which, most people just don't think that they're going to happen or that they're in the works. It's sort of the downside of actually having a pretty effective police force, really.
Well, I would maybe adjust what you're saying a little bit. I think now, for the first time, we are under real genuine threat. But before, and these are not my words, these are security specialists that describe Canada as the aircraft carrier from which Islamist will establish himself and then launch towards the United States. So the organized Islamist operatives who had a foothold in Canada for whatever extended period of time had no interest of making Canada vulnerable to terrorist attack. If they would have done so, the aircraft carrier principle would have disappeared.
Right.
So now it's a different ballgame because the United States have been so weakened by its foreign policy, by the current administration, and even the former one, but much more the current administration. They have they're losing control and their influence abroad. So a lot of these rogue state and rogue leaders are just taking a stand. And Canada is not as important as it used to be able to reach within the United States to be able to make attack. But let us not forget that one of the first Islamist attack prior to September 11 that was going to happen was the Millennium Bomber, who was a Montreal-based, Algerian-born, radicalized individual that was crossing the border between Canada and the U.S. to go bomb the L.A. airport.
Actually, you know, people often forget about the Marc Leduc, which wasn't his original name, the fellow who shot those girls from the École Polytechnique.
Marc Lépine,
Marc Lépine. And, you know, his father was a Moroccan Muslim, and he was raised as a very strict very strict religious Muslim, and his actual words when he was shooting all those women was that he felt that women shouldn't be getting an education.
he was totally against women. And when you see the way he was geared up, he looks exactly like the combatants that are in Syria. He had military gear. He had a machine gun-like weapon. The police stayed in the lobby when he was shooting these women in the classes. So unlike September 11, when the cops would go up and try to save people, the Montreal police stayed in the lobby while this guy was shooting. But anyway, this is a very bitter story and a sad one in Montreal's history. But his name for most of his life was actually Gamil Garbi and not Marc Lépine.
Right.
And they used his case. The feminist movement in Canada used his case to focus on guns.
Yes, of course, and feminism, because, you know, you couldn't walk two blocks without seeing a candlelight vigil, and they were perfectly happy to demonize all men for the actions of what that particular Muslim did in pretty much, anyway. So the point is, yes, Canada has seen jihad. We just insist on pretending it's otherwise. Don, are you with us? Don, are
hello?
You?
Hello?
Hey, you're
hello.
Okay, terrific. I don't think you gentlemen have met before or spoken together. Don Laird, this is Marc Labouy from Pointe à Bascule. And last week, Don, you were talking about a particular mosque that was seemed to be disproportionately large and expensive for the community that was going into. I'm wondering, perhaps Mark knows something about that. Could you explain where it is and what those numbers were again, please?
Well, first off, greetings from Alberta there, Mark. How are you today?
Very good, very good. I heard you're having some snow out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's just that's a bit of an understatement. Yeah, old man winter is showing up a little early, so I'm going to get my Christmas shopping done just in case Père Noël shows up tomorrow or the day after. But, yeah, we're getting, in the parlance of Western Canadians, we're taking a bit of an ass-kicking out here from a meteorological point of view. So, but thanks for asking. It's actually, I'm quite pleased to speak to you. I'll give you a little bit of background, and then I tend to be a little bit long-winded, so I'll try and aim for brevity here. As we're seeing in the Middle East, we're seeing OPEC and we're seeing a lot of the oil-producing nations throughout the Middle East, and their ability to power broke with respect to global economies. We're seeing that waning somewhat with the advances in technology here in North America, with the recent gas finds off the coast of Israel, specifically the Haifa field, where they stumbled into, I think it was 700 billion cubic meters of natural gas within their 200-mile limit. And there's actually another field just adjacent to that one, which looms to give Israel essentially energy independence, which is essentially, for lack of a better word, no pun intended, terrifying the Saudis and the Qataris, et cetera, et cetera. We're seeing the emergence, in North America of our very stable oil supplies. Canada is, in fact, only second to Saudi Arabia in proven reserves. And this has created quite the ripple effect in Riyadh with respect to their ability to influence global economies. Well, what we're seeing here in Alberta, essentially around the oil sands, is the recognition by the Islamists, by the Muslims, that essentially Alberta will be the hydrocarbon engine for North America. It will give us that independence from foreign oil, and this is terrifying the Muslims as well. What we're seeing throughout Alberta is not only becoming a farm team for jihadis that are exporting their wares around the world, but we're seeing within the city of Fort McMurray, we're seeing essentially an attempt to establish a caliphate. The vast majority of the local administrators on school boards, principals, teachers, a lot of the teachers, a lot of the town administrators are extremely leftist, very liberal, very sympathetic towards the Muslims. Even the local RCMP, a Constable Jenna Wood and a Constable Kirkwood, were photographed cavorting about a local Muslim meeting wearing hijabs, not having any insight into what is a weaponized article of clothing, They were very proudly grinning, had their photograph taken, and it was published in a local newspaper with these two RCMP officers wearing hijabs. The mosque that Vlad is referring to goes to essentially the attempt, or to sort of that beachhead foothold. They're building a mosque with their, or they're planning, they're in the planning stages of building a very large center that actually includes a mortuary within the mosque. There's gymnasiums, et cetera, and it's being put out to the Fort McMurray residents as sort of a warm and fuzzy area, sort of a multicultural center, an area of peace and understanding. And the estimates, and it's a very, very large center, the estimates with respect to cost range between $30 to $40 million. But here's sort of the fly in the ointment. The local Muslims in the area number anywhere between about 600 to 1,000. A lot of red henna dyed beards can be seen in the area, a lot of dishdashes, very traditional Orthodox Muslim garb is worn locally, a lot of hijabs, but that's only probably in about 100 or 200 of the local residents. The rest are just, I imagine, normal, regular, everyday Muslims. What they represent their numbers to be, and this goes back to Turkey, and a sort of Muslim-sanctioned lying in an attempt to influence the local politicians, they represent their numbers in excess of 10,000. Now, there's only approximately 50 to 60,000 residents within the city of Fort McMurray, which is the energy capital of Alberta and North America. And then there's an additional transient population of about 20,000 temporary workers that come and go on a rotational basis to work in the large oil sands mega projects. So what we have here, and I'll just come up for air real quick here, we have a $30 to $40 million mega mosque being set up in what is essentially the energy capital of North America by 600 to 1,000 very politically active Muslims, about 100 to 200 of which are the for lack of a better expression, the rabbit foaming at the mouth sort of Orthodox Muslims, the jihadi types. And this is happening right in Fort McMurray, and this we don't even begin to touch on, for example, the incoherence of police forces such as the Edmonton Police Service, the Calgary Police Service, with respect to facets of Islam and jihad, and the jihadi farm team. There's Naheed Nenshi, which is the mayor of Calgary. He's a Muslim. Recently, there were Hamas supporters who were out actively demonstrating on the streets of Calgary. That resulted in outburst of violence, which was ignored by the Calgary police chief. It was ignored by the mayor of Calgary. There was an incident in, of the many incidents, there was an incident in Edmonton in which a group of gay men were protesting at a local Islamic center, and their car was smashed, all the windows were broken, it was vandalized. And the Edmonton Police Service was just, they were just beside themselves trying to get this vehicle off the street because the owner of the car had put up signs on the side of the car that said, smashed by Muslims at the Islamic Center of Edmonton. And it was whisked away and put into a police impound. So what we're seeing in Alberta is essentially just off the chart, but it's really the quintessential example of a beachhead foothold being set up in what will be the energy capital of North America can be seen in Fort McMurray, and it's extremely disturbing. So I'll just I'll come up for air and listen to your comment here.
Well, definitely. When a couple of months ago, even a year and a half ago, I spoke with Vlad and telling him that Alberta is definitely a hotbed of Islamist activity in Canada.
Don, can you, I think I'm hearing a bit of breathing coming. Can you maybe mute the mic on your phone just while you're listening? Is that possible?
Okay. Do you still hear the breathing now?
No, not right now. Thanks.
Okay, good. Sorry about that.
Sorry. Mark, please go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. We've been noticing, just by looking, the transfer of funds between several Islamic organizations in Canada using as a reference to main organizations such as Irfan Canada, who has now been listed as a terrorist organization a couple of months ago. When we look at the fund transfer towards Irfan Canada, Alberta played a huge, huge role in transferring fund towards Irfan before the Irfan was basically got their charity status revoked. So there's a lot of activities over there. There's also a community in Edmonton, because the Muslim Association of Canada, or if you want, the Muslim Brotherhood operating in Canada, have tried to establish a school in a shopping mall area. They purchased this kind of rundown shopping mall area in an area where there was basically no Muslims. And the community over there organized very spontaneously with the right attitude, basically. They focus on the organization. They said they do not want to have a school that is run by an organization that is linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. And they were able to get some traction, and now in the city of Edmonton now, they will not allow any more religious organization to purchase shopping malls to be able to transform them into religious institutions. But why I'm saying this is the infiltration is so advanced in Alberta that the school system in Edmonton are now propagating classes to explain what Islam is based on the scholars of the Muslim Brotherhood. So when you see in the reference text, they have the text of Yusuf Qaradawi, who's considered to be the equivalent of the Ayatollah Khomeini for the Sunni world. You have text of several other scholars that are basically promoters of the conquest of the West, or the conquest of anything that is not Islamic. And one will have to wonder as to why we have so many radicalized Muslims that are reaching out to the different jihad fronts around the world. Well, it starts in the schools, and these are public schools. Why I'm saying this is all related to the whole what I call the Alberta web. Yes, Fort McMurray plays a huge role because there's a lot of people that are landing, let's say, in Quebec and Ontario, and they maybe are not finding the proper type of jobs and they're moving out there. It's true that Saudi Arabia in 2006 technically declared a trade war with Canada when they discovered that Canada became the first oil exporter to the United States, and by the Minister of Oil, and for him, this was a huge, huge surprise. And from there on, there is a document information that came up from Arab News, which is the English-speaking media of Saudi Arabia. And there's a lobby of Saudi Arabia that was basically boosting, or if you want, basically proud to have to declare that they have successfully been able to counter a policy that was established by the U.S. Congress to counter or to stop purchasing foreign oil, or if you want, Middle Eastern oil. What they have done is they use a California regulation which describe clean oil, and they imposed on the Pentagon, which is the largest consumer of barrels of oil on the planet, more than any countries in the world, and imposed on the Pentagon to consume clean oil. And the way they describe clean and dirty oil, well, basically oil sand qualifies as dirty oil.
I see.
Right. Just a couple of comments on that, and you take a look at the declared war, and that's an excellent point that you make, Mark. You take a look at the declared war. You go back to an incident, and this was widely covered by Sun TV, and thank God it was. I mean, had it not been for the emergence of Sun TV, there was such a poverty of conversation, or certainly of exposure, with respect to the Islamic agenda in Canada. And you know, with the emergence of Sun TV and the creation, we have had volumes spoken about what's going on in Canada. But the point that I'm referring to was Ezra Levant and his sponsorship of an organization called EthicalOil.org.
Yeah, yeah.
And they came out, and Saudi Arabia, and essentially when you take a close look at what Saudi Arabia did, Saudi Arabia retained the services of a little litigator employed by Norton Rose, one of the largest law
yes.
firms in the world. His name was Rahul P. Agarwal, and he started sending off little nasty grams to Ezra Levant and to Sun TV over their references to Saudi Arabia. The women can't drive. They're essentially considered owned property. They're not allowed to go out. And this was referred to in an ad that was run by Ethical Oil. And suddenly we see one of the classic examples, tools in the Islamic tool chest, which is Lawfare. And we had Saudi Arabia retaining law firms and trying to essentially slap down Sun TV. And when you take a very close look at that, what they're doing is they are tampering with the national security and the national sovereignty of a foreign country, specifically Canada. And that is, if anybody's seen my writings knows that I can be somewhat hysterical and sort of inflammatory, but that's getting pretty close to the open warfare. When you start tampering with somebody's economy and trying to influence governments from the inside, that's pretty close to being off the chart. And then, another comment that I had in regards to Fort McMurray, looking for the money and trying to chase the money trail in Fort McMurray, most of the Muslims, the Orthodox, the henna-dyed beards and the dish-dashes and the hijab, most of these people are, in many cases, functionally illiterate. They work at Walmart. They make $12 and $13 an hour. They work as taxi drivers. They have menial, sort of low-skilled positions, so they're not making a lot of money. How do 200 to 300 Muslims managed to cobble together $30 to $40 million to build a massive complex in what will be the energy capital of North America? I mean, if that's the elephant in the room, I don't know what is.
Well, you had the visit of a Kuwaiti ambassador a couple of weeks ago, and Kuwait Petroleum invested $4 billion, I think, a year or two ago in the oil sands.
Well, there's an old expression, Mark, and it's called possession is 9/10 of the law. they can invest all they please, but we're here, they're over there, and their investment is on paper. And I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, they recognize what's happening in North America as a direct threat to their ability to generate billions of dollars in cash to influence global economies, and it is absolutely terrifying them. And so what we're seeing in Alberta is essentially what I would refer to as the very thinly veiled plan and attempt to establish a caliphate infrastructure within Alberta. But going back to one of the things that you mentioned, and this is goes back to the Holy Land Foundation trial, and I'm quoting loosely, when you take a look at the points that you made, one of the things they said in a document that's translated from the many cases and boxes of documents were seized from the mosques and from the offices of these organizations that were linked to the Holy Land Foundation trial was a document that referred to something called the Grand Jihad. And essentially the senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood were saying was, consider your work in North America to be a kind of Grand Jihad by which you will destroy the miserable house of the West from within and by their own hand. And in those few sentences, you have exactly a mirror image of what you said, but also it's extremely chilling because they've recognized the futility of banging on the front doors of Western civilization with swords and shields. And they've understood from a very crafty, very intelligent point of view the benefit of coming at us from within. They've decided to take protections that we have created through the formation of a civilized society over the past 2,000 years to what we have now, protections, human rights protections, the rule of law, a judicial infrastructure. They've recognized the useful nature of those protections that are afforded to bona fide, sincere participants in the Western democracy. They've recognized the usefulness of those protections as weapons to be used against us. So not only are our own protections being used against us, but we're up against things like indifference, we're up against apathy amongst the general population, we're up against ignorance. I mean, if you ask the most fundamental questions about Islam, on you know, of a passerby on the street, most of them wouldn't be able to answer those questions. And then the last thing the last point that I wanted to make, and perhaps I can get you to comment on this, is they recognize the laziness of bureaucracy and bureaucrats, and they recognize that need to serve for the bureaucrat to serve themselves and to take the path of least resistance. So in the case of, let's say, for example, the police force would rather ignore the complaint of the citizen who is complaining about, for example, Islamic excesses, rather than tamper with an Islamic community where, you know, 1,500 heads are going to explode over a cartoon and they're going to have riots in the street. So better to take the path of least resistance by ignoring the civilized member of a Western society rather than confronting the criminal behavior of the Muslim. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I, you know, of course, we live in a society where people operate with interests. And I don't know if you've seen the series The House of Cards. But,
no, I haven't.
Okay, so there's politics where people get elected, and then there's also the behind-the-scene politics. And Canada always thought in a certain way that it was similar to the United States, but when you really look at it properly, it's a winging of laws and all kinds of sub-legal structures that have been created with a very, 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 very strong government intervention or government participation in people's lives. And all this government intervention is tools that are being used to give legitimacy of anybody who would like to infiltrate or if you want to operate and be able to move further their agenda. So this said, we are having some very, very, very serious problems in Canada. I think I'm starting to think now that our problems are as serious, even more serious than some countries in Europe that we thought were serious. In United States, now we have Sun TV, I agree with you, but that's very recent in Canada. Prior to that, there was basically no opposing form of media in Canada, unlike the United States, where there are still, even though they may not be considered mainstream, but still important counter opinions in the media. People open media such as the Front Page magazine. They're going to have access to Pajama Media. They're going to have access to serious magazines that will give a perspective that is very, very different from what you hear through mainstream media. And even Fox News plays a certain role into this. We didn't have that until recently in Canada. Now, this said, what's happening? Now, try to imagine this. You're having a daycare. I'll give you an analogy, and I repeat 50 times, this is an analogy because it's going to be very disgusting. Imagine you're running a daycare and you're a parent. The people in charge of the daycare comfort you, and by saying, we will hire the most competent people to take care of your own children in our daycare. These people are charismatic, they are loved by the children, and they also adore children, and we recruited them in some of the finest institutions where the pedophiles are the most numerous. So in so many words, we are being told that we're hiring pedophiles to take care of children in a daycare. Why am I using such a catastrophic analogy? It's because this is exactly what is happening within CSIS, within the RCMP, and within, even under the current government, within the government that is supposed to take care of our security. The last report we wrote with Hassan Hamdani, when you look at his track record, who's a core key advisor to the Minister of Security through the to what is called the Cultural Roundtable on Security Group, basically has a history of links with radical organization that based all the way back to 2003. He's the one who basically funded, organized with Saudi money the first revival of the Islamic Spirit Convention in Canada, in Toronto in 2003. This was a time when extremely radical people were invited. One of the key keynote speakers at that time was a Saudi cleric, basically who became almost, I think, the Mufti of Saudi Arabia, who was invited. And just to tell you the irony, and think of that analogy with the daycare that I just told you, in 2006, less than 3 years later, he goes see Stockwell Day because of the Toronto 18 incident, and basically says, we need to compete against petrodollars. The moderating voices of Canada, the Muslim moderating voices, cannot compete with petrodollars. Canada needs to fund us, me, or if you want to say, the moderate voice, to counter radicalism. So in so many words, we gave legitimacy by the institutions that have a unique power in Canada, of all the institutions, or if you want, of all the government agencies that have the power to do a level of due diligence that no other agencies can do. These people have not done their due diligence to check the track record even on Google of this guy, and they gave this guy and two or three other of his cohorts a position to be able to influence the vocabulary that our security agencies are using to describe the threat that we are faced with. And they still cannot answer as to why Canada might be the number one radicalizing country in the world right now.
No, so, and you make, sorry, go ahead.
So this man, Hussein Hamdani, who is still on the council, advising, who most likely has been advising the new director of CSIS, Mr. Coulombe. Basically, Mr. Coulombe, for the first time, presented a report from CSIS to the Senate committee, and for the first time in 8 or 10 years, there was no words to define the Islamist terms such as jihad, caliphate, or the peripheral words that are used to be able to describe what the former CSIS director used to describe as the most dangerous, the first threat that Canada needs to reckon with. It's Sunni Islam or radicalizing Sunni institution in Canada. These are CSIS terms of 1.5 years ago, not my words.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's one of our, sorry, did I cut you off there, Vlad?
No, that's fine.
That's one of the most, for me, and this is just a personal, it's a personal comment, one of the most disturbing facets of essentially the Islamification of Canada as it moves forward is the infiltration of our law enforcement agencies and our judiciary. It's the infiltration of our judicial infrastructure, starting from law enforcement, moving up to the judicial phase, to the final punitive phase, to our intelligence infrastructure through the RCMP, through the military intelligence, through CSIS, CSEC. These people are well placed. I mean, there's a sanitizing of the vocabulary within these organizations, so that you can't even speak the name of the enemy. You can't even speak about words like you said. You can't speak like words like Islamist or jihad, et cetera, et cetera. But on top of that, it's the infiltration of those organizations and the access that those people have to highly classified documents or even to run-of-the-mill information. So as an example, and I'm pointing out the elephant that's in the room. I'm not shooting myself in the foot here, so bear with me. As somebody who writes, not extensively, but occasionally in direct opposition to both our bureaucratic cowardice, the shortcomings of our politicians, and the present Islamification and its sort of its various stages within Canada and conditions within Canada, if anybody wants to know where I am, and they are sympathetic or they are an Islamist, and they are within, for example, Calgary Police Service, Edmonton Police Service, or the RCMP, they have access to all of the databases through the law enforcement, and a person who is in opposition to the Islamification of Canada can be very easily found. And that is extremely troubling, that these people have access to tools and to resources that should be sort of above and beyond their reach.
In the 90s, in Quebec and Ontario, they were fighting the motorcycle gang wars. And some of the Hell's Angels were able to identify certain individuals that were later on assassinated. And there was a person working within the government of Quebec who had access to personal information related to driving license permits. And she just would send out this information to the key Hell's Angels who were able to use this information later on to go assassinate some individuals. What you're talking about is extremely very real and very, very true. I personally have been exposed to this kind of situation myself, face to face with a person representing the police force in Montreal, who, by the way, did not master neither French nor English. And he was hired as part of the intelligence of the Montreal Police Force. I am one of the first one in Canada to have organized a conference by Muslims who wanted to alert the Canadian population of the dangers of political Islam and Islamism, and making sure that we would understand that this is not something that concerns only Muslims. And basically this individual literally started to speak about Islam, started to tell me, this is a person from the police force, who would basically tell me that the words that the conference or the speakers of my conference would say may offend some people within the university, within the community. I had to remind him that that was not my concern. My concern was that he would protect the individuals that I'm inviting. So that's the level of situation we're in. There's several Muslims that I know who are anti-Sharia, anti-Islamism, if you want to have it that way, and they had received death threats, and they wanted to make special complaints, and of course, because of the multicultural policies of some police forces, they received two agents who were representative of the Muslim community who begged that these Muslims do not file any report because it could be damaging to the Muslim community's interests. Now, that's pretty intimidating.
Well, you make an excellent point. It's extremely intimidating. The very same, the infiltration of law enforcement by criminal elements, and not referring to Islamists, but just criminal elements, as you were saying with the Hell's Angels in Montreal, that very same thing happened with sort of the girlfriend-boyfriend thing out on the West Coast where the RCMP, a member of the RCMP, was doing a little pillow talk with a woman who was a relative, I believe a blood relative of one of the Hell's Angels, and while she ended up taking that information that she was getting from her evening sort of rendezvous with this RCMP officer and passed it on to the Hell's Angels. So just on an ordinary level, I mean, when you as an ordinary citizen, you become, not, I wouldn't say paranoid, but you become concerned. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit of static here, but you become concerned about people around you, about relatives, et cetera, et cetera. And no doubt, if there's any Muslims listening to this who are Islamists, they're sort of soiling themselves with laughter because it's the intended effect. They want to intimidate. They want to cow. They want to create paranoia where there is no threat, and they want to threaten when there is no threat. They want tools.
I just want to take this opportunity to raise a related issue, because it's going to be an issue in Canada very soon, and it is one in England right now. I believe the British government raised their terror alert level to salmon or to fuchsia or something. And it's apparently the highest level of terror alert. And with that, they're asking the public to report on any suspicious activity they see. And it occurred to me that if anybody was foolish enough to actually do that in the UK, they would almost immediately be arrested for racism or be humiliated or insulted or dismissed. and possibly go on a list for having dared to suggest that something they saw, perhaps, you know, somebody who appeared to be Islamic might have been doing. Now, that's clearly going to happen. The terror level, alert level is going up everywhere. It certainly is or will in Canada. And I was thinking about somebody that I know that I ran into recently that was telling me about how they had a religious epiphany. He was a regular kind of a cult, what I call a cultural Muslim, in the sense that he had no interest in his religious background, but, you know, he was born here and his father was Islamic and his mother wasn't. And he'd had a religious epiphany and how he was really starting to understand things in a very metaphysical way and was basically reading about it studiously, and I'd noticed that he'd changed which hand he wore his watch on and was growing a beard and so on and so on. And I was thinking, gee, you know, I wouldn't, you know, if we're supposed to report who we think might be getting ready to go fight jihad, like, who's going to do it when you know that we've managed to undermine ourselves to the point where there's a greater penalty to you for actually reporting what you suspect, even though you've been asked to, than if you don't? The consequences to the individual are certainly lower if you say nothing.
Well, I mean, that's an excellent point, Vlad, and that goes, I'm not going to steal Mark's thunder here because he's a spotlight guest here, but that goes back to what happened in France in the Second World War. That's totalitarian society that you refer to. That's what happened to the Vichy government. And that's what looms large here in Canada. Certainly what would be grist and fodder for a show at a future date. And this is one of the questions that I wanted to ask Mark is, we've all identified the elephant in the room. We all know what's happening. But we don't seem to have, and maybe it's a good thing we don't have a central organization that can be targeted by the Muslims, but we don't seem to have an organization or an organized push that is directing an effective response against what's happening in North America. I mean, and I'll ask Mark this, I mean, are we still at this point, I mean, I recognize the ignorance that's out there amongst the average person. In Alberta right now, I'm putting together an informational pamphlet organized, sort of a push. We'll have that out probably in the next 3 or 4 months. And what that is, essentially pamphlets that will be passed out to people that will be educational on a very basic level, that will sort of get them started and rolling. But aside from that, where do you see this going, and what do you see as the most effective response to this so far in North America?
Well, I first of all, I'll start with an example. In London, Ontario, there are four individuals that were in the leadership of the, I don't know if you remember, about a year ago, the Algeria gas plant attack.
No, I remember that high school.
Yeah, and they were most likely, anyway, they went to, they did visit two mosques over there. One of them is run by Wahil Adara, who was the president of the Muslim Brotherhood operating in Canada, the Muslim Association of Canada. And the other one was Munir Al-Qassem, who was in a leadership position of an organization that has lost its charity status for funding terrorism, and he was linked to Gaddafi. Now, this guy, Qassem, is not only linked to radicalism because of that organization, but he has a really, really long portfolio of associating with extremely radical people, and you don't need to be a policeman to be able to identify that. You could just go on Google. Now, this guy received from the London Police Force a promotion. He became the chaplain of the London Police Force. You see him on pictures. He's wearing a uniform. Now, can you imagine, let's say, Muslims who are liberal, let's say, or free thinker, or who believe a little bit like Zudi Jasser in the United States, who really believe in the values of North America, and they would like to tell us what's happening within the community, but look who's in the police force. You understand what I'm saying?
So how do you deal with that?
You know, I don't have
like, I'm not asking you for the magical answer.
I do not have an answer. No, I do not have an answer, and I'll tell you why. Before coming up with a solution, for me, I'm dealing with, let's say, a new level where we are now focusing on the agencies that are victims of influence by Islamist operators. And we're talking the same thing as Hamdani, the last report we published. Now, if I had to make a recommendation, it's before coming up with de-radicalized solutions that have failed, like in England with the Prevent strategy, where they basically funded radicalizing or individuals and institutions to de-radicalize youth. So basically they were radicalizing with de-radicalizing public funds. And right now, Canada, you're hearing people in Ottawa who would like to establish a model like Prevent in Canada, even though it failed in England. So basically what I'm saying is, the first thing we should recommend to the police or anybody who may have an ear to do something about this is we're going to have to make sure that we clean up the already the elements that were integrated into the different sensitive agencies, institution, or police forces. If we don't do that, even with the solutions that we're going to come up with, or even with any law that's going to come up with, the elements that are problematic who now have joined the forces will basically do what Jamal Badawi has been recommending, and it's basically to take advantage of their influential position in order to stop applying current legal provisions that are incompatible with their ideology or Sharia law. We're really in a critical situation. I'm not here to talk about doomsday. All I'm saying is we're almost like at the height of the Cold War, and we haven't yet discovered how deep, far, and wide Soviet agents have penetrated the military, the highest level of our intelligence services, and which was the case. Now we know with clear records and documentation that they infiltrated far deeper than we could have imagined, all the way up to the 80s.
Go ahead, Vlad.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I really think that a lot of it's easier to re-subvert the public back into its own interest than it is to actually try to deal with this problem because I think what's happened is you look at what the Frankfurt School and these various Islamic groups did, and in cooperation with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which you could argue is a real caliphate, and you say what they've done is subvert the culture first and then force our institutions to follow suit. And I think that's a lot easier than actually, you know, the most obvious thing would be to try to go after these institutions and clean the weeds out. I don't think
we
can
do
that.
Well, we have to stop funding them. We have to stop. This is where we can go. The first thing is to identify where there are public funds. You know, instead of talking, for example, about immigration, we should talk about the money that is being spent, which are incredible. I think it's almost like $250 million per semester by the federal government, who has trickled down all kinds of cultural institution and organization all over Canada with the role of integrating the newcomers into this country. And several of these organizations, such as CISO in Ontario, are basically controlled by Islamist operatives. So basically they're coming from abroad, they're being incubated into keeping what Muslim Brotherhood ideology, Islamic values, and that's what they call integration into Canada. So the problem is not so much immigration. The problem is that we're funding the radicalization of the newcomers.
Oh, yes, I totally agree. In fact, we haven't got enough time to really go as deeply into this. And you know what, Mark? As I figured, we're just, even though the show's an hour and we've now done an hour and a half, there just wasn't enough time to cover, and we didn't even take a break. Look, what I wonder if you'd be available to come back, if not, like either next week or the week after, and pick this up again, because I just think the work that you do is so important and needs more exposure. Would you be willing to come back on the show at some point and discuss
Let's talk about a date later on. We'll look, and it will be a pleasure.
And Don, thank you very much for being such a great contributor again. Your breadth and depth of knowledge is fantastic, as well as, you know, you have some great insight about this from your own thought. I just want to take this last couple of minutes, if I could, to mention there's a project that I've been working on with a lot of great volunteers over the last about 5 weeks. I think I've mentioned it. I've been trying to avoid too much detail because, you know, you don't want to jinx a project till it's done, and you don't want to spook anybody till it's done. But basically, the first draft of it's now online just to be looked over by the participants. I plan to release it basically the minute that the first plane hit the first tower on 9/11, you know, coming up in a couple of days. And so about whatever, 9:53 a.m., whatever time it was, I want this particular project to go live. And I'll tell you what it was. I worked with a bunch of great, great people. I think most of the listeners are going to recognize at least three of them. They're quite well known. And they were kind enough to participate with me in this project. And the project was that on the first day of Eid this year, maybe around the end of June, early July, first day of Eid, the new Islamic State produced a video, and it floored me. I've never seen anything like it, and I've watched a great deal of material by and about this on this subject. And it was absolutely a sea change, what I saw. And I recognized its tremendous importance. And I sent it out to a bunch of people whose names everybody would know, who also were floored by this and were kindly volunteered their time to help me make a video about that video. So that, and then I managed to save it before YouTube took it down. They did. YouTube is having its own internal problems trying to decide what to allow and not allow. Actually, I have a great deal of sympathy for them, to be honest with you, because I think they're between a rock and a hard place. But I don't think that they're evil yet. Anything that big is going to be. But at the moment, I genuinely think they're okay. But what I'm trying to say, long and short of it, is that I managed to save this video and have it put up on other people's servers. And I'm basically just finishing up this video with these guest experts who will be explaining why what you see is so important, how to interpret it, how to understand it. And I'm hoping that's going to be up on Vlad Tepes blog and on Gates of Vienna and any other site that wants to post it and anybody else who wants to even host the videos on their own YouTube channels. Lively channels, you're more than welcome to do so. I think it's really important that people understand the evolving nature of Islamist behavior and logic and rationale and how it's going to affect us all. I think knowledge may or may not be power. It certainly is. But knowledge also is the first course of defense. Once again, I really want to thank Kel Red Fox for doing all the technical work and the legwork to make this show possible. Really great of you to do it and to keep me on my toes as well. And two brilliant guests, and I can't thank you enough. You will hopefully be back, if not next week, the week after. It's great to have the Canadian thing, as we said at the beginning, the Canadian issue isn't as sexy as some of the others because we haven't caught, some of these things haven't happened because we've caught the perps, and other things have happened, but we've kept it hidden. I could think about a possible Islamic rape gang trial that happened in Ottawa, but everybody was a minor, so they kept the names out of the papers. Although I think the people that really ran the thing behind the scenes were not minors. That's a topic for another show. So, you know, once again, Mark, Point About School, links in the chat room. When I post this show up on the website, I'll make sure the link is there. But people should basically pour themselves a stiff drink and sit down and go through the articles that he has. There's excellent research. And once again, Don Laird, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule out there in oil land and calling in. And Kelly, you got something you can play us out with?
I most certainly do.
Wonderful.
It was a wonderful show. Gentlemen, I am honored that you're part of the Red Fox Blogger program tonight. You've been listening to Islamic Issues with Vlad Tepes. And Vlad, I do. I have your closing song.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good night,
guys. Good night.
Good night.